Where are we? 3:40.
Eight.
Yeah. First column. Not so hard, I don't think. This idea of canceling and effective. If I've got it right, in the Pleroma, the opposites cancel each other, but they're effective. In the consciousness, they don't cancel each other, and they're effective. What's the difference? Well, so that's the first three paragraphs there on 3:48. Opposites that are unconscious lead nowhere forward, but they mess up everything in their environment. In other words, it's when people say one thing one minute and one thing the next. That's damn irritating. It has an effect. But those contradictory statements lead nowhere. That's what I think he's driving at.
But they don't even notice it.
And they certainly do not notice
it. Because we all have done it, I'm sure, at one time in our lives.
Yeah. But you know, you pardon my going back to that Swiss thing, but I told some of you, I think, on Saturday, how this guy, my host, told me that these two big apes in the group don't listen to them. You know what they're insulting. Don't worry about it. And then when the final attack came, he joined them. See, two opposites.
Mm.
Yeah. And so it had an effect, which is I don't like you, but it led to nowhere. I think that's what he means by they cancel each other out in the Pleroma, but they're effective. But they're effective in a negative way. And when they're conscious, when you wrestle with them, then they can be effective in a positive way. Namely, you wrestle with them and you seek the synthesis of the two.
And that is Tao. You don't cling to one opposite of the other. You search for the middle path.
Right.
But they still cancel each other, even using consciousness.
No, I don't. Well, they cancel each other in the sense that the third neutralizes them, but then a creative result ensues.
Better to say they balance each other more?
Yeah, you could say.
Mm-hmm. Holding them allows the creative response to come forward. Is that what you're saying? When
yes,
you're holding,
exactly.
You're consciously holding the opposites.
Yeah.
I say this or feel this and this at
yeah.
the same time.
Yeah.
And you just stay with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then a creative response happens, jumps out of those two things.
Mm-hmm.
That's funny. I remember one thing I remember Marion Gibson saying, fear, when she hold the tension.
Yeah.
Hold the tension.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that I've got
that. That's it. Hold attention is consciously working with the opposites. And then, you know, as we have talked, when you hold the tension, the unconscious will produce the synthesis. And that's the positive effect. So when he says the unconscious contents cancel each other out, but are effective, we could say are destructively effective. But consciously wrestled with opposites are creatively affected. So you don't get that in those sentences. You have to think where he's taking it and realize what he's driving at. That's where I think it's so confusing. So it says, distinction from them saves us. And the opposites are unconscious. You're one person one moment, and you're another person the next moment. You're identified with the opposites. Like that guy. One moment he says one thing, he's one person. Next moment he says another thing, he's another person. But when we differentiate ourselves from the opposites, we say, gosh, I've got these two tendencies. Where's the truth? I can't speak from either side until I see where, how I can act that I'm not a hypocrite. All of this then, this would set the stage for Jung's working on the opposites in alchemy. These little sentences. Now, I think the next to the end of that, to the break in that column, the idea is, what do you strive for? Do you strive for good, beautiful? And the answer is no. You strive to be who you are. Which will have some good things about it and some painful things about it.
I think that's important what you say, because sometimes when a person thinks about their essence, they think, oh, well, that's all good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's easy to think that way.
Absolutely. And that, I think, is our Christian heritage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to do good. I want to do good. Rather than to find out what is there for me to be and do and live it, and out of that a positive effect will come. But I can't intend goodness.
Yeah, but who's determining the quality of good and beautiful? I mean, what does that mean? Who is the one who's saying, this is the good thing, this is the beautiful thing, and these are the ugly things?
Well, usually it's
society,
the person. Yeah, society, the church.
Okay.
So that even talked about the unconscious identifying things as good or beautiful.
I think you could say that.
Or evil.
And I think in the work with Nietzsche, he was bringing up the same idea that sometimes it's in the ugly and the evil that the new thing comes through, unfortunately.
Right.
And sometimes we have to go into that in order to come out the other side.
Absolutely. And you can see how wrestling with this material here set the stage for his work with Nietzsche. This is raising questions which Nietzsche expressed in a more literary and historically relevant form, but it's the same issue. You know, Zarathustra was the guy who established good as the desirable 2,500 years ago.
Just as an example, reading his books, I'm just thinking of this, but between as in discipline and training, you can use power and force your will on someone. Like this horse puts his father did, both of his horses and to him. So he came out and, you know, he came out resentful and he tried to reform, you know, to think about that. We came up with, how can I work with horses and
train them
without killing their spirit and forcing my will on them just because I had the means to do so and more power than you do as an animal. I can, you know, tie you up and whip you, which is what his father did to train his horses. But then he took it and said, no, there's another way. And if I find out, you know, what their essence is and how they communicate, then really the horse is more than willing to help us and loves to work and is generous by nature, and I just need to be able to harness that in a good way, constructive way for me, without ripping them. And I think that's such a... And then even Jung said, you know, where there's power, there's no love.
And what he turned to was the horse itself. He didn't say, I'm going to be a good horse trainer. He said, let's learn from the horse how this works. That's a big difference. You could say his dad was saying, let's make good horses. And he was saying, let's make horses that are horses. I think that's a beautiful example.
One of the things I did on my trip in Florence was, previously I had come across the story of Elizabeth Barrett Browning and Robert Browning. And Elizabeth's father was a tyrant, much like your horse trainer's father was. He forbid any of his children to marry, and he tried to control them all with money and power, and was very successful, and had really convinced Elizabeth that she was an invalid and would be an invalid her whole life. And through a meeting, through letters, actually not meeting in person for 3 years, she and Robert Browning started writing to each other. They eventually secretly married with the help of servants and family, and then escaped to Florence. And there in Florence, they both created their, you know, most creative pieces of work, which are really difficult to read and understand. But so I wanted to see their home there and found it, and you could tour it. There was a lot of sadness there, and it cost something for her to leave that. You know, she did the sin. She escaped. She left the fold in order to be a creative individual, and that's the same kind of thing. But I just felt so much sadness in that house.
Did you?
Yeah, a lot of sadness.
Yeah, this guy's still carrying it, you know, what his mother did to him, because he beat him.
Beat the son. Treated the son like a horse.
Like he did the horses, yeah. And the giant, you know, that's what made him, he didn't want to do that, you know, so firm. And I got to find another way. So that with the creativity,
right.
The darkness, you know, knowing that the effect that has on the victim is that it embitters and brings out resentment and kills the spirit more than anything. Kills their innate spirit to want to work and to help and to complete a task. I mean, horses love to do that. But the father basically just killed them into submission. So, I mean, Rick, oh man, there's got to be a better way, he said.
I think you could, I wonder if you could almost always say that goodness, the intent to goodness and a power complex go hand in hand. I think that's what Jung is slowly realizing.
Kathy, just curious, what did the sadness come from? Was it because you already knew a great deal about their lives, or were you picking specific things somehow?
Yeah, I think when she died there, she died there, and maybe I was picking up the loneliness that Robert and their son felt. I don't know. I just...
Was this where she grew up, this house you
said? No, this is the house that she and Robert escaped to Florence. They knew that they would have to get way far away from her father.
Okay.
So they made this little apartment near the Boboli Gardens there in the city palace where the Medici lived. And just 5 rooms that they lived in their whole life together.
She outlived him?
She died. She died about, they had quite a few years together, but she died there. I think she died at, they may have had 10 years, maybe more than that together. I think she was 40-something when she passed away. She fell off a horse actually when she was young, and so she did have some health issues. But her father pretty much convinced her to never get out of bed again. And Robert, with Robert's love and encouragement, she started working on her health secretly behind her father's back. Mm-hmm. So that stepping away from that system of tyranny, you know, then led to her most creative works. So,
you know, that Jung's definition of love is giving the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
And to me, that is so important, and it's so true. If you are in conflict with, and you supposedly love somebody, you got to give them the benefit of the doubt if you really love. And that, you know, instead of imposing the will, like the father just wanted to own the daughter instead of really love her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about imposition of will. You know, instead of stepping back and saying, well, maybe she has a viewpoint. Maybe she should do it. So it just, to me, that was just so, when you said that definition of love is just so giving, it's so generous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, as you can imagine, the dead don't like this and they grumble.
I didn't get it.
Now, this next paragraph is another puzzle. I'm at footnote 88. Oh, yeah, this is where it says, in the published version of the sermons, these commentaries that follow each sermon do not appear, and nor does Philemon. That's answered your question, Jane. So it sounds like what the I published, I think that's the one in the appendix of Mysterium. Of memory, streams, reflections, and so it must have been edited down a bit, but the essence is the same.
There's a lot of explaining that goes on
here
in his conversations with Philemon after the
lecture. Yeah, apparently that was cut out. The person delivering the sermon has been assumed to be Basilides. These commentaries were added in the scrutinies.
Well, and that's when they were written. I see.
I don't know. That's a good question, Carol. Maybe not. Maybe it was the other way around.
They were taken away?
That the first version, which you referred to last time, Carl, remember where the doorbell started ringing and there was nobody at the door and the kids were acting weird and one of his daughters had a weird dream? That might have been when he wrote the seven sermons, which is published in Memory Streams Reflections. And then this, maybe, was picked up and expounded upon.
Is it in Memory Streams Reflections?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's in the appendix.
Oh, it's in the appendix.
Yeah.
So I couldn't find it. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. I knew I'd seen it there, but I couldn't look at the appendix.
So I turned to Philemon and said, "My father, you utter strange teachings. Did not the ancients teach similar things? And was it not a reprehensible heresy removed equally from love and the truth? And why do you lay out such a teaching to this horde, which the night wind swirled up from the dark blood fields of the west?" The phrase that puzzles me is "the dark blood fields of the west." I assume that means from World War I, because the battles would be going on to the west of Switzerland. You could also take it, the west as the area of the setting sun and death, and it could be both, that these figures have, remember, these are the people that were Christians, but had their full Christian belief taken from them, thanks to the church fathers. And so they're up and around looking for an answer to the emptiness in their soul. This is my way of putting it. The emptiness in their souls, and what they're getting is that part of Christianity that was taken from them 1600 years ago, when Gnosticism was declared a heresy. So it could be that those dead are dead in that sense, and it could also be that Jung's or this voice is saying this point of view is missing from contemporary life. That's why they're killing each other in the war.
Well, a lot of the men that fought in World War One have lost their faith. I know that from reports from my grandmother.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm speaking, I suppose, specifically of the men in England.
Yeah.
They were separated from the church.
Uh-huh.
And there was a big movement of what they called spiritualism at the time, which was, you know, a search for some sort of spirituality outside of Christianity. That was very
well,
big.
Well, yeah, here we go.
That mm-hmm. was very big in England at mm-hmm. that time.
Mm-hmm. And so what we're seeing here could be, the implication would be, well, this is behind our warlike mentality. And my son Philemon replied, these dead ended their lives too early. They were seekers and therefore still hover over their graves.
And there you go, they were seekers.
Their lives were incomplete since they knew no way beyond the one to which belief had abandoned them. So apparently I take that to mean that Christianity wasn't working for them anymore, as it was passed down to the modern era.
And that reminds me of what you said about Teilhard de Chardin,
right.
That he said in the battlefield of the Lord.
Right.
But it was an image of
Christ
coming out of the
No, world. Christ descended and became the battle. That's got to be an authentic vision of the 20th century.
Excommunicated for that?
He wasn't excommunicated, but he wasn't allowed to publish.
He could publish when he, because he was a, if you study rocks, what are you, paleontologist, he could publish that. Anything you want to publish about the rocks. Otherwise, keep your mouth shut. And, I mean, he was so demoralized.
Yeah, I think it must
of
have
course.
Destroyed him.
Well, he said, God, if there is anything in my work, this is a really old memory, but I think he asked to die on Easter Sunday. Whatever he asked, he was granted that. If there is something to my work, then that's a sign. And he was given that wish and that prayer.
So the top paragraph, 348, second column, it's just saying kind of what I just said. They had a faith, but it wasn't adequate. And they're looking for more. Then, in the next paragraph, comes the distinction between belief and knowledge.
Which I see as a very foundational Jungian.
That is foundational, yeah. See, there it is in one paragraph. But it's foundational. And I think that we've got the essence then of the first sermon. Anything on that? Jump into two, where I am lost.
You know, I had to think about Jung's world in a certain way to understand this. And when I thought of Abraxas as the god in the process of transformation, Helios as the old god image, then it all made sense.
Okay, well, go girl.
That's all I got to say, sorry. Because if he's a god image in transition, then that's why he is called the effectual, the effective.
Yeah.
Because that is
you're referring to Abraxas.
Abraxas.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
And if he's distinct from Helios, which is God,
yes,
then that makes sense too, because
yeah.
Helios would be the passing God image, all of the qualities that are no longer working, all the things we follow. And that's why there are two gods there. In effect, there are two gods he's talking about.
Maybe that's the key then.
Which is Helios versus Abraxas.
Versus Abraxas.
And Abraxas is destructive and creative, destructive and positive. He's everything. He's life. He's force, duration, and change. And that makes sense if you think of it as a transitional symbol that's trying to hold our changing needs within it.
I think you can justify what you just said from footnote 91. God is dead. Is God dead? And then Jung, which we know, but here the quote just confirms it. For Jung, that isn't a metaphysical statement. That's a psychological statement that we need a new image of God. That's what you're saying in different words, I think. And the way the editor cites that, the very last footnote on 348, the next to last line, he, God, has discarded our image. And where will we find him again? So I think you're on target. So let's see. God's not dead. He is alive as ever. God is creation, for he is something definite and therefore differentiated from the Pleroma. God is a quality of the Pleroma, and everything I have said about creation also applies to him. But he is distinct from creation in that he is much more indefinite and interminable.
Because he changes.
Now, is that Abraxas we're talking about?
Yes. Because he goes on to say the ground of his essence is effective.
Yeah. So, I might just fine-tune that a bit. He might be saying, by implication, Abraxas, but I think what he is saying is the foundation for that thought, which is God, no matter what you talk, is what is effective fullness. So let's stop saying what is God. Let's look for what effective fullness is, and that's God. And I think what was effective in history at that moment was the war. That was the most powerful event of the time.
And thus you can, as you mentioned, Abraxas is that.
Yeah, and so that's God. Yeah. No matter what you say God is what is happening, and deal with that fact. No point in constructing theories about God or beliefs about God. Look at what's happening. Look at the strongest force behind what's happening. That's God.
But that's only in the collective or the external effectiveness of God. Jung himself was working out an internal effectiveness of God. So was Thomas Mann, the Magic Mountain, and other creative people were working on the inner effectiveness. So it wasn't just the war that was where God was manifested.
But I think with Jung, though, he would say you have to take the collective manifestation as your starting point. And then you transform it. Because the starting point is horrible.
But that doesn't mean that the individual isn't working on some piece of the manifestation of
the individual is working on some manifestation of that horror and transforming it into a
because there, it contains all aspects,
right,
positive and negative. So
right.
I suppose an individual could be working on a positive piece or a negative piece.
Either way, but I think what Jung was working on was the negative piece. How do we take this rageful God and turn it into a guide? Turn it away from its destructiveness.
And that's what is behind the neurosis is the healing.
Yeah. That's how I would put it.
Well, the other place that he uses that word effectiveness is when he's talking about the pleroma and what isn't the pleroma.
Right.
So he talks about in the pleroma, that's everything and nothing, and it's effective, but we talked about that as negative effectiveness.
Right.
It isn't creative.
Right.
He goes ahead and says the pleroma is ineffective also. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I thought that's what he says it's effective, but
okay,
not in a positive way. But then the... I'm just playing around here.
No, you're on something. Keep going.
Then the potential within each of us, when we wrestle with that and are creative out of the opposites, when those opposites then become out of the one, two, and we hold that tension, and that's creative effectiveness. And so now we're saying God is creative effectiveness and fullness. So somehow that all comes together, and I'm not sure how.
Well, it comes together in a huge contradiction.
Okay.
That the effective thing at that moment in history was evil.
Okay.
Basically, he's saying God is evil.
Okay. Also.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really not that far from traditional theology, what little I... was not able to get out of my system from graduate school. Tillich's God is your ultimate concern. That's standard Christian Sunday morning theology. I would have asked Tillich, so Hitler's ultimate concern was killing Jews. Was that God? And Jung would have to say, yes. I think if theologian really thought through contemporary theology, they couldn't sustain it. So what Jung is saying is, in the spirit of modern theology, yeah, God is your ultimate concern, and you cannot put an ethical limitation on that. If Pol Pot kills 6 million Cambodians, that's his ultimate concern. That's just the same as Mother Teresa's ultimate concern being saving people in the dying in India. And Jung is saying, so let's follow through with that thought to its bitter conclusion.
And if you do that, Hitler's ultimate concern was the purification of the German race.
Yeah.
And the thousand-year right.
Mm-hmm.
Which was the takeover of the world by that purified German.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
is a horrific idea.
In his mind, was the ultimate good.
Yeah.
So, the ultimate good leads to the ultimate evil.
Right.
And it has been pointed out by some people that it's not published very many places because it's not considered very good taste, but... Mother Teresa's ultimate good of saving all of these children, she did not believe in any birth control, would lead to a population explosion that would ruin our world.
Mm-hmm.
So her ultimate good would also lead to ultimate evil, just like Hitler's.
Now, don't freak out, because The other thing Jung is saying is you have to differentiate that. So it's not saying we should stop with that, but we should start with that. I think that's the difference. Locate that untransformed God in yourself and transform it. But don't make your starting point some lovely theory about God. Make your starting point what is effectively driving your times and your life. See, it takes that out of the realm of the mind and of belief and puts God as a fact. But as a starting point. Now, he doesn't say that here. But Abraxas is a starting point. So where we're going is God is Abraxas, but as a starting point, because Abraxas is trouble. He says, from Jane's presentation and the visions, Abraxas doesn't conform to our spiritual expectations, but to our worst fears. Whatever it is that's driving you and your society is your starting point. And if it's your ultimate concern by modern theology, and I don't disagree with it, it's your ultimate concern. So I think that's, Carol, I think you've helped unravel. That's effective fullness. So when God is the Pleroma itself, that would be Abraxas. Effective emptiness, I'm on 349. First, you okay with that so far? Effective emptiness is the essence of the devil. God and the devil are the first manifestations of nothingness, which we call the Pleroma. So that when we say effectiveness is God, we have to accept that we can't say that God is good. God is also the devil.
You can't really say. Yes, but we're totally in the realm of the effective.
Yeah.
So you can't say that God, you said that God is the Pleroma itself, that would be Abraxas. No, the Pleroma itself has no effectiveness. Abraxas is effective. Abraxas is...
I see what you're saying, yeah.
Abraxas may be causing evil, and he can potentially cause good too, I guess, but you know, but he's the evil that was left out of the balance, so...
Now say what you said in the beginning again. What is not the Pleroma?
Gary made the statement that when God is the Pleroma itself, that would be Abraxas, he said that.
Well, God is a quality of the Pleroma. And also not. So it's a paradox, right?
Well, that'd be fine. But Abraxas is a differentiated quality, as I'm understanding it here, taken away from the Pleroma and becomes the effective.
What helped me was what I brought up last week with the two tones, with the Pleroma being on the side of what cannot be known. And as soon as it comes through to the side that it's an image, it's Abraxas. It's good and evil.
Yeah, I think you're right, yeah.
There's no effectiveness. What doesn't matter, you know, what Jung has always said was, it doesn't matter what's metaphysically out there behind the God image. The God image is what is effective in the world. Mm-hmm. That is all that matters. And it's effective evil, it's effective good, it's the ultimate concern. And it is tied to something that's behind it, but we can never know what that is. So we need to not worry about it. We need to look and redo this God image to make it effective in a non-evil way.
Right. So, Go ahead, Carl.
What you're saying is that when the God image leaves the pleroma, it becomes effective and it becomes abraxas.
Split, yeah. And differentiated.
I might say something like, abraxas is the pleroma beginning to step out of itself. It's a mess, but we didn't write it. We're just trying to understand it.
Say that again. Abraxas
is the pleroma beginning to step out of itself. Which is how I take this idea that God, the devil always belongs to God. Everything that differentiates takes out of the pleroma. Everything that differentiation takes out of the pleroma is a pair of opposites. Therefore, the devil always belongs to God.
Because in the one, you can't see the two.
Yes.
Until you're this side of it. And mm-hmm. So then the two comes out, the opposites. And then you have an opportunity there to see, but what Christianity did was separated
right.
them and kept them separate
right.
when they really belong together.
Right.
And there is no differentiation, there is no ability to perceive without that splitting up.
So, to sum up so far, this second one, I believe I would say... We're talking about a praxis. We'll talk about it more later. And he's what's going on in the world. I'm really paraphrasing now. He's what praxis is what's going on in that war. And the fact that it's so strong means this is what we gotta deal with. We gotta deal with it in ourselves. And find out how to make the presence out there that's destructive in here be creative. And that will foreshadow how our image of God needs to change. But I think that the key idea here is, he's not saying it, but I would say, theologians, shut up. Look at what's moving the world. That's what God is. It doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter what you believe in. So today, God would be greed. That's what's moving the world. And that's not a heretical or blasphemous statement. It's just looking at where we have to start. It isn't where we have to end up. That's how I would paraphrase so far, is number two, taking off from your comment. Well, we're out of time. Let's say we've got as far as a first, second, third paragraph on the first column of 349. And I had you read over to 351, I believe. I don't think we'll get farther than that, but just... to punish ourselves, let's read over to the beginning, the fifth sermon at the break in the first column of 352.
Bracket 10.
I know this stuff going, but I think it's important.
And you think here indeed as I.
It may very well be, Jane.
And there's so much terror in there.
Ironically, this is something we can play with, so think about. I wonder if terrorism is the other opposite to greed.
Opposite.
Well, that they belong as a pair of opposites.
The haves and the have-nots.
That's the haves and the have-nots. I don't know, I was just seeing, there was an article about Dominican Republic, you know, they've it passed a law that only the children born of foreign parents in the Dominican Republic can't receive citizenship. And so they had pictures of the living conditions. It is appalling. No wonder. Why would they not be violent? What have they got to lose? And we know the state of that island is thanks to the French. They went in there and just stole every bit of wealth they had. So we may have hit something here. Certainly for the terrorist, terror is their god. I don't approve of it, but I can understand it to a certain extent.
My a friend of mine says that there are so many young male terrorists because these young men have no access to women, and their natural bodily function of having a mate, because all in Islam that's all restricted.
Yeah. Well, that's another way to look at it.
Something to think about. What
something
part of
to think about.
Energy might be coming from?
Yeah, I have no answers here, but I think these are questions worth entertaining, because we go with you. God is what is moving history.
There's no access to women because what?
Because their religion. Because of the religion of Islam, they're cut off from women. The young men are, unless a marriage can be arranged. Or you can't just have a girlfriend. You don't allow yourself that.
It's like being a priest, and you know, the destructiveness that has caused.
Mm-hmm.
For some, being a priest.
It's like being a priest.
Mm-hmm.
But it's forced on you instead of chosen by you.
Yeah, and yet you're...
And all the feminine in your own feminine side as the priest. I mean, all femininity is flawed.
I was flying from Rome to Pisa, and a priest sat next to me on the plane. And he was on the aisle, and he sat like this the whole time, almost falling into the aisle. He did not want to be close to a feminine being.
Well,
it was.
You said, hey, by the way, you stop by sometime.
Oh, I was just
come
like,
on up.
I could not believe it. It's not
to be a priest.
Well,
I they say
a lot of the young men over there don't have a way to make a living. They don't have
poverty.
A way to be creative. Don't have a way to, you know, to invest themselves into becoming something. So they fall into the schools of terrorism.
Which is the same here with gangs.
Mm-hmm. Right, bullying. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could take it in levels here in our country.
It would be like gangs are all out of
your girls. Healthcare is the thing that's always making you crazy.
Well, just think about how doctors are educated. You know, my son-in-law is real interested in doing a little bit to change that, and that good old boy system of, you know, working until, yeah, and you have people's lives in your hands, but that's not even considered, you know. They went through it, you have to go through it. Right.
Well, we'll keep the discussion going, but you see how he's trying to reshape things. And
I guess you have to go through the process of getting into a discussion with it. Like, you don't say you're adjusting to the dregs of your complex.
You can say about everyone.
Yeah, that's for you.
Okay.
And you've got everybody's
contact. And you see the absurdity of it, and then I guess that's...
And look at it in yourself. And two. Look at it in yourself. Where's my greed? Where's my terror?
I'm taking those with you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do I terrorize myself?
Yeah.
I'll bring
well, sure.
I'll bring
okay, thank you. See you in 2 weeks.
I'm back from...